Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're diving into a really major figure in modern thought.
Yeah, Ludwig Wittgenstein. He's pretty colossal, isn't he?
Definitely. And maybe a bit intimidating.
Yeah.
But he's someone who didn't just, you know, add to philosophy. He fundamentally changed the game.
Right. He made people question what philosophy should even be doing.
Which is why we're turning to A.C. Grayling's book, Wittgenstein. It's such a helpful guide through his ideas.
It really is. And, you know, if you've ever felt tangled up in arguments about what words mean or just lost in abstract thinking.
Which is probably everyone at some point.
Probably. Then Wittgenstein, especially through Grayling's lens, offers a way towards, well, clarity.
Exactly. We're not getting bogged down in the super dense original texts here. Grayling gives us a kind of map.
A map showing this lifelong quest Wittgenstein was on, trying to figure out the boundaries between language, our thoughts, and, well, reality itself.
Yeah, and Grayling argues his real mission, his sort of ultimate goal, was to show us the limits of our own communication, where it works and where it trips us up.
And what really jumps out from Grayling's take is this idea of philosophy, not just as finding truths, but as therapy.
Therapy, how so?
Like dissolving the mental knots we tie ourselves in using language. It's a way to understand those linguistic traps we fall into all the time.
Okay, that's a really interesting angle.
And to guide us through someone this complex, you really need the right guide.
Which brings us to A.C. Grayling himself.
Right. Anthony Clifford Grayling, he's a really well-known British philosopher, a public intellectual, founded the New College of the Humanities. Quite distinguished.
And what makes him particularly suited for this subject?
Well, he comes from that analytic philosophy tradition, you know, the very world Wittgenstein himself came out of.
And then sort of turned on its head.
Exactly. So Grayling has the insider's understanding, the scholarly chops to get the logic, but he also has this amazing ability to make really abstract stuff feel accessible.
That's key for Wittgenstein, I think.
Totally. And Grayling strikes this great balance. He doesn't treat Wittgenstein like some kind of untouchable guru, which some followers tend to do.
Right.
But he also doesn't dismiss him as just, you know, an overrated puzzle. He shows the revolutionary ideas, but also their actual practical value for thinking clearly.
Okay, so let's get into the book itself. Grayling structures it as a philosophical biography, doesn't he?
Yes, and that's crucial. He really emphasizes how Wittgenstein's life, which was incredibly intense, often quite troubled.
Giving away that huge fortune, the simple living.
All of that. Grayling argues it was completely tangled up with his philosophical journey. It wasn't separate. It was one single kind of existential struggle.
A struggle for what exactly?
Clarity, fundamentally. Grayling's central point is that the whole project, even though it seems to have these two really different phases.
The early Wittgenstein and the later Wittgenstein.
Right. It was all driven by this one deep problem. How does our language actually hook onto the world? How does it connect?
And this is where you get that dramatic shift, the two phases. Can you sketch those out?
Sure. So first, you have the early Wittgenstein, the author of the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus.
Catchy title.
Yeah. And in that book, he built this incredibly rigid logical system. The core idea was that language works by picturing facts.
Picturing, like a photograph.
Sort of. He thought meaningful sentences had to share the logical form of the reality they described. Like a blueprint mirrors the structure of a building, he was hunting for the basic building blocks, the logical atoms.
Okay, very precise, very logical.
Extremely. But then, decades later, he rejects it all. In his later work, The Philosophical Investigations.
He said his own masterpiece was wrong.
Completely wrong, or at least deeply misguided. He moved away from that rigid picture idea to something much more fluid, more pragmatic. The idea that the meaning of a word isn't some fixed thing it points to, but just how it's used in the flow of human life, in our activities.
He called those language games.
Right? Exactly. Language games. A huge shift.
But wait, if the Tractatus was supposedly this perfect logical structure, why abandon it? What did Grayling say was the big flaw?
Grayling points to dogmatism. Wittgenstein came to see his early work as too rigid, too detached from how language actually works in the real world.
Oh, okay.
And this connects to that therapeutic goal we mentioned. Grayling argues that both phases, despite their differences, were aimed at dissolving philosophical problems.
How so?
Wittgenstein realized many deep philosophical puzzles weren't about the world itself, but about misunderstandings of our own language. Confusion.
So philosophy becomes about clearing up that confusion.
Precisely. Freeing ourselves from the bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language. That's his famous phrase.
Okay, let's dig into that early phase more, the Tractatus. Where did that precision obsession come from?
Grayling traces it back to his background. He studied engineering, even aeronautics. He had this intense drive for exactness, for problem solving.
Like building a machine.
Kind of, yeah. And that pushed him towards logic and towards Bertrand Russell, who became his mentor. He wanted philosophy to be as buttoned down, as rigorous as, well, a mathematical proof.
And that led to this picture theory.
Yes. The core idea, again, is that for a sentence to mean something, it needs to share the logical structure, the form of the fact it describes.
You mentioned the sheet music analogy before.
Right, like how musical notation on a page shares the logical arrangement of the sounds. If a sentence doesn't map onto a possible fact in this logical way, he thought, it's just nonsense.
Yeah.
Literally nonsense.
Wow, that's restrictive. What does that imply for things that aren't straightforward facts?
Yeah.
Like ethics or art or the meaning of life?
Ah, well, according to the Tractatus, those things fall outside the realm of what can be meaningfully said.
So you just can't talk about them.
Not in a factual, descriptive way. They become part of the unsayable. This leads to that incredibly famous final sentence of the book.
Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent.
Exactly. And Grayling interprets this not as dismissing ethics or aesthetics, but as protecting them.
Protecting them, yeah.
By saying, look, factual language, the language of science, has its limits. These other important things, value, meaning they can't be captured by logical propositions, they can only be shown through actions, through art, maybe through silence itself.
Okay, that puts a different spin on it. It's not dismissive, it's reverent, almost.
Grayling certainly sees it that way. But then, after this monumental work, Wittgenstein basically disappears from philosophy for a decade.
Right, the silent years. He went off to teach school kids in rural Austria. And designed a house.
Yeah, a very stark modernist house for his sister. And Grayling argues these practical hands-on experiences were absolutely crucial.
How so? What did they show him?
They showed him the massive gap between his neat, abstract logical system and the messy, complicated, context-dependent reality of how people actually use language every day.
Like teaching kids who are just learning to talk or giving instructions on a building site.
Exactly. None of that fit neatly into the picture theory. It forced him to confront how language really functioned in practice.
And that must have taken incredible intellectual honesty, right?
Yeah.
To basically say, my famous masterpiece.
Mm.
Yeah, it's fundamentally flawed.
Immense courage. He saw the Tractatus itself as a kind of dogmatic trap he'd fallen into, so he had to start over.
Which leads us to the later philosophy, the investigations.
Yes. And the big shift is away from language as one single thing, a picture machine, towards seeing it as this huge, varied toolbox.
The toolbox.
Yeah. Full of different tools that do different jobs. Language isn't one thing. It does countless things.
And this is where language games come in.
Precisely. He stopped asking, what is language?
Yeah.
Or what is meaning? And started asking, what do we do with words?
Okay. Give me an example.
Grayling uses Wittgenstein's own example. Think of a builder on a site yelling slab to an assistant.
Okay.
What does slab mean there? It's not just pointing to the object. It's an order. It's part of an activity, a whole system of learned practices and expectations.
Ah, so the meaning is in the use within that specific game, that activity.
You got it. That's the absolute core insight of the later work. The meaning of a word is its use in the language. Context is everything.
And to explain how concepts work without needing strict definitions, he used that idea of family resemblance, right?
Exactly. Think about the word game. What single thing do board games, card games, ball games, Olympic games all have in common?
Well, not much when you put it like that. Rules, competition, fun, not always.
Right. Wittgenstein argues there isn't one single essential feature. They're connected like members of a family by a whole network of overlapping similarities. Some have this feature, some have that one.
Like a family resemblance, literally. Some have the family nose, others the eyes.
Perfect analogy. And this was a direct attack on that classical philosophical urge to find the one perfect definition, the essence for everything.
Okay, so meaning is use. Concepts are like families. What about private thoughts or feelings? How does language handle those?
This leads to one of his most famous and maybe trickiest arguments, the private language argument.
That's complex.
Grayling explains it using the famous beetle in a box thought experiment. Imagine everyone has a box, and inside is something they call a beetle. But here's the catch. No one can look inside anyone else's box. Only their own.
Okay, so.
So Wittgenstein asks, how could the word beetle possibly have a shared meaning? If it just refers to my private sensation, how do I know I'm using the word correctly? How do I establish rules for its use? How do I even know if what's in my box today is the same as yesterday?
Right, there's no public check, no way to agree on the rules.
Exactly. Grayling clarifies Wittgenstein's point. For language about anything, even supposedly private sensations like pain, the rules for using the words must be public. They have to be learned and used within a shared community, a shared form of life, as he called it.
So meaning isn't a private mental picture, it's a public skill we learn.
Yes. It's embedded in our shared practices. Meaning is social.
Wow. Okay, and all of this, the language games, family resemblance, the private language point, it all circles back to that idea of philosophy as therapy.
Right back to it. The goal is to show the fly the way out of the fly bottle.
The fly being us, trapped in the bottle of our own linguistic confusion.
That's the metaphor. Philosophy's job isn't necessarily to build grand new theories, but to carefully examine our language and untangle the knots we tie ourselves in, to achieve clarity.
So if we boil it down, what are the main takeaways Grayling emphasizes from all this?
Well, first, definitely the linguistic turn. This idea that so many problems, philosophical but also everyday ones, stem from misunderstanding how language works, especially treating abstract words.
Like justice or mind or freedom.
As if they were names of simple objects you could just point to.
Right. So instead of arguing about the definition of fairness, you should ask,
how is the word fairness being used in this specific situation? What game are we playing with it? It shifts the focus entirely.
Okay, that's huge. What else?
Second, the social nature of meaning. Our ability to talk about anything, even our inner lives, depends on shared public practices and rules. It really challenges that idea of the totally isolated individual mind figuring things out alone.
We're inherently social thinkers because our main tool, language, is social.
Precisely. Third, there's the critique of essentialism. This is so liberating, we can stop wasting time searching for the perfect single definition for complex concepts.
Like art or knowledge or truth.
Yeah. Instead, we look at the family of uses, the overlapping ways these terms function. It's much more pragmatic. It frees us up to just use concepts effectively in context.
And finally, Grayling really stresses the practical relevance of all this.
Absolutely. Understanding that different groups might be operating within different language games with different unspoken rules and assumptions can make a real difference.
Where? Like in specific situations?
Think about legal arguments or business negotiations or even just family disagreements. Recognizing you might be playing by different linguistic rules can be the first step to better communication, maybe even resolution.
That makes a lot of sense. Wittgenstein's work is also incredibly quotable, isn't it? Grayling uses some key ones.
Oh, definitely. They really stick with you. One of the most famous from the early Tractatus is, "The limits of my language mean the limits of my world."
That sounds quite profound. Maybe a bit bleak. Does it mean we're just trapped by our vocabulary?
Grayling is careful here. It's not really psychological limitation he means. It's more logical. What you can think coherently is tied to what you can say meaningfully within the rules of logic. If you can't form a logical proposition about something, it falls outside the boundary of the sayable world.
Okay, it's a logical boundary, not a prison wall.
Kind of. And that boundary leads straight to that final Tractatus line we keep coming back to.
Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent.
And again, Grayling reads this as respecting what lies beyond factual description. Honoring the ethical, the aesthetic, the mystical, by not trying to force it into the wrong kind of linguistic box.
Right. Then from the later work, The Investigations, the absolute core idea is summed up as,
the meaning of a word is its use in the language. Simple but revolutionary. It marks that massive shift from logic as picture to language as practice.
From the armchair logician to the observer of human activity.
Exactly. And finally, there's that beautiful metaphor for the whole philosophical project. What is your aim in philosophy? To show the fly the way out of the fly bottle.
Philosophy is liberation from self-inflicted confusion.
Yes. Not finding new facts, but achieving a kind of clarity, a release from the ways language itself can trap us. It's therapy through clarification. And Grayling really helps us see how to apply these ideas, doesn't he? He makes it practical.
Yeah, like in arguments. You mentioned shifting from definitions.
Yeah, right. So next time you're stuck arguing about, say, what counts as respectful behavior, instead of trying to nail down a universal definition of respect.
You ask something like, okay, in this situation, what specific actions are you calling respectful or disrespectful? Or how are you using that word right now?
Exactly. Focus on the use, the language game being played in that context. It moves you from abstract deadlock to something concrete you can actually discuss.
That could probably diffuse quite a few arguments.
Potentially. And another application Grayling suggests is using Wittgenstein's skepticism as a kind of jargon detector.
Huh. I like that.
Well, when you hear overly complex, abstract language, especially in business or politics, you know, leveraging synergistic paradigms or whatever.
Yeah.
Ask for the cash value, as the pragmatists would say. Ask, can you give me a concrete example of how that works in practice, if they can't?
Then the language might just be idling, as Wittgenstein put it, not actually doing any work.
Precisely. It's a great way to push for clarity.
And there was also a point about empathy.
Yes. Related to the idea of different forms of life, when we encounter beliefs or practices from other cultures or even just other groups, that seems strange or illogical.
Instead of just dismissing them.
We can try to understand them as part of a different coherent system of practices, a different language game with its own internal logic. It encourages intellectual humility, a broader perspective.
That's a really valuable takeaway. For me, reflecting on Grayling's account, what really struck me was how he connected the two Wittgensteins.
Yeah, how so?
Well, you often hear about this dramatic break, the early logician versus the later ordinary language guy. But Grayling makes it feel like one continuous, incredibly intense quest.
A quest for?
For absolute clarity, uncompromising honesty about how language really works. He wasn't just changing his mind. He was refining his method because the old one didn't meet his impossibly high standards for truthfulness about language. That integrity is amazing.
That's a great point, that relentless intellectual honesty really shines through in Grayling's portrayal. And I think for me, the final thought is about the legacy. Wittgenstein didn't leave us a fixed system of answers.
No, definitely not.
He left us a method,
yeah.
A way of thinking, a way of paying incredibly close attention to our words and how we use them.
Tools for clarity.
Exactly. Tools to stop torturing ourselves with questions born from linguistic confusion, and instead to gain a kind of practical wisdom by becoming more careful, more aware masters of our own language. You stop being trapped by language and start thinking with it more clearly.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.